ancient philosophies, the analysis of the mind is still rudimentary and imperfect. It naturally began with an effort to disengage the universal from sense. This was the first lifting up of the mist. It wavered between object and subject, passing imperceptibly from one, or being, to mind and thought. Appearance in the outward object was for a time indistinguishable from opinion in the subject. At length mankind spoke of knowing as well as of opining or perceiving. But when the word knowledge was found, how was it to be explained or defined? It was not an error, it was a step in the right direction, when Protagoras said that man is the measure of all things, and that all knowledge is perception. This was the subjective which corresponded to the objective, all is flux. But the thoughts of men deepened, and soon they began to be aware that knowledge was neither sense, nor yet opinion, with or without explanation, nor the expression of thought, nor the enumeration of parts, nor the addition of characteristic marks. Motion and rest were equally ill adapted to express its nature, although both must in some sense be attributed to it. It might be described more truly as the mind conversing with herself, the discourse of reason, the hymn of dialectic, the science of relations, of ideas, of the so-called arts and sciences, of the one, of the good, of the all. This is the way along which Plato is leading us in his later dialogues. In its higher signification, it was the knowledge, not of men, but of gods, perfect and all-sufficing. Like other ideals always passing out of sight, and nevertheless present to the mind of Aristotle as well as Plato, and the reality to which they were both tending. For Aristotle as well as Plato would in modern phraseology have been termed a mystic, and like him would have defined the higher philosophy to be knowledge of being or essence, words to which in our own day we have a difficulty in attaching a meaning. Yet, in spite of Plato and his followers, mankind have again and again returned to a sensational philosophy. As to some of the early thinkers, amid the fleetings of sensible objects, ideas alone seem to be fixed. So to a later generation, amid the fluctuation of philosophical opinions, the only fixed points appear to be outward objects. Any pretense of knowledge which went beyond them implied logical processes, of the correctness of which they had no assurance, and which at best were only probable. The mind, tired of wandering, sought to rest on firm ground, when the idols of philosophy and language were stripped off. The perception of outward objects alone remained. The ancient Epicureans never asked whether the comparison of these with one another did not involve principles of another kind which were above and beyond them. In like manner, the modern inductive philosophy forgot to inquire into the meaning of experience, and did not attempt to form a conception of outward objects apart from the mind, or of the mind apart from them. Soon objects of sense were merged in sensations and feelings, but feelings and sensations were still unanalyzed. At last we return to the doctrine attributed by Plato to Protagoras, that the mind is only a succession of momentary perceptions. At this point the modern philosophy of experience forms an alliance with ancient skepticism. The higher truths of philosophy and religion are very far removed from sense, admitting that, like all other knowledge, they are derived from experience, and that experience is ultimately resolvable into facts which come to us through the idea. Still their origin is a mere accident which has nothing to do with their true nature. They are universal and unseen. They belong to all times, past, present, and future. Any worthy notion of mind or reason includes them. The proof of them is, first, their comprehensiveness and consistency with one another, secondly, their agreement with history and experience. But sensation is of the present only, is isolated, is and is not in successive moments. It takes the passing hour as it comes, following the lead of the eye, or ear instead of the command of reason. It is a faculty which man has in common with the animals, and in which he is inferior to many of them. The importance of the senses in us is that they are the apertures of the mind, doors and windows through which we take in and make our own the materials of knowledge. Regarded in any other point of view, sensation is of all mental acts the most trivial and superficial. Hence the term sensational is rightly used to express what is shallow in thought and feeling. We propose in what follows, first of all, like Plato in the Theaetetus, to analyze sensation, and secondly to trace the connection between theories of sensation and a sensational or Epicurean philosophy. Section I. We, as well as the ancients, speak of the five senses, and of a sense, or common sense, which is the abstraction of them. The term sense is also used metaphorically, both in ancient and modern philosophy, to express the operations of the mind which are immediate or intuitive. Of the five senses, two, the sight and the hearing, are of a more subtle and complex nature, while to others, the smell and the taste, seem to be only more refined varieties of touch. All of them are passive, and by this are distinguished from the active faculty of speech. They receive impressions, but do not produce them, except in so far as they are objects of sense themselves. Physiology speaks to us of the wonderful apparatus of nerves, muscles, tissues, by which the senses are enabled to fulfill their functions. It traces the connection, though imperfectly, of the bodily organs with the operations of the mind. Of these latter, it seems rather to know the conditions than the causes. It can prove to us that without the brain we cannot think, and that without the eye we cannot see, and yet there is far more, in thinking and seeing, than is given by the brain and the eye. It observes the concomitant variations of body and mind. Psychology, on the other hand, treats of the same subject regarded from another point of view. It speaks of the relation of the senses to one another. It shows how they meet the mind. It analyzes the transition from sense to thought. The one describes their nature as apparent to the outward eye, by the other they are regarded only as the instruments of the mind. It is in this latter point of view that we propose to consider them. The simplest sensation involves an unconscious or nascent operation of the mind. It implies objects of sense, and objects of sense have differences of form, number, color. But the conception of an object without us, or the power of discriminating numbers, forms, colors, is not given by the sense, but by the mind. A mere sensation does not attain to distinctness. It is a confused impression, ? As Plato says, until number introduces light and order into the confusion. At what point confusion becomes distinctness is a question of degree which cannot be precisely determined. The distant object, the undefined notion, come out in relief as we approach them, or attend to them. Or we may assist the analysis, by attempting to imagine the world first dawning upon the eye of the infant, or of a person newly restored to sight. Yet even with them the mind as well as the eye opens or enlarges. For all three are inseparably bound together, the object would be nowhere and nothing, if not perceived by the sense, and the sense would have no power of distinguishing without the mind. But prior to objects of sense there is a third nature in which they are contained, that is to say, space, which may be explained in various ways. It is the element which surrounds them. It is the vacuum or void which they leave, or occupy when passing from one portion of space to another. It might be described in the language of ancient philosophy, as the not being of objects. It is a negative idea which in the course of ages has become positive. It is originally derived from the contemplation of the world without us, the boundless earth or sea, the vacant heaven, and is therefore acquired chiefly through the sense of sight. To the blind the conception of space is feeble and inadequate, derived for the most part from touch, or from the descriptions of others. At first it appears to be continuous, afterwards we perceive it to be capable of division by lines or points, real or imaginary. By the help of mathematics we form another idea of space, which is altogether independent of experience. Geometry teaches us that the innumerable lines and figures by which spaces or may be intersected are absolutely true in all their combinations and consequences. New and unchangeable properties of space are thus developed, which are proved to us in a thousand ways by mathematical reasoning as well as by common experience. Through quantity and measure we are conducted to our simplest and purest notion of matter, which is to the cube or solid, what space is to the square or surface. And all our applications of mathematics are applications of our ideas of spaced matter. No wonder then, that they seem to have a necessary existence to us. Being the simplest of our ideas, space is also the one of which we have the most difficulty in ridding ourselves. Neither can we set a limit to it, for wherever we fix a limit, space is springing up beyond. Neither can we conceive a smallest or indivisible portion of it, for within the smallest there is a smaller still, and even these inconceivable qualities of space, whether the infinite or the infinitesimal, may be made the subject of reasoning, and have a certain truth to us. Whether space exists in the mind, or out of it, is a question which has no meaning. We should rather say that without it the mind is incapable of conceiving the body, and therefore of conceiving itself. The mind may be indeed imagined to contain the body, in the same way that Aristotle, partly following Plato, supposes God to be the outer heaven or circle of the universe. But how can the individual mind carry about the universe of space packed up within, or how can separate minds have either a universe of their own or a common universe? In such conceptions there seems to be a confusion of the individual and the universal. To say that we can only have a true idea of ourselves, when we deny the reality of that by which we have any idea of ourselves is an absurdity. The earth which is our habitation and the starry heaven above, and we ourselves are equally an illusion, if space is only a quality or condition of our minds. Again, we may compare the truths of space with other truths derived from experience, which seem to have a necessity to us in proportion to the frequency of their occurrence, or the truth of the consequences which may be inferred from them. We are thus led to remark that the necessity in our ideas of space on which much stress has been laid differs in a slight degree only from the necessity which appears to belong to other of our ideas, e.g. weight, motion, and the like. And there is another way in which this necessity may be explained. We have been taught it, and the truth which we were taught, or which we inherited, has never been contradicted in all our experience, and is therefore confirmed by it. Who can resist an idea which is presented to him in a general form in every moment of his life, and of which he finds no instance to the contrary? The greater part of what is sometimes regarded as the a priori intuition of space is really the conception of the various geometrical figures, of which the properties have been revealed by mathematical analysis. And the certainty of these properties is immeasurably increased to us by our finding that they hold good, not only in every instance, but in all the consequences which are supposed to flow from them. Neither must we forget that our idea of space, like our other ideas, has a history. The Homeric poems contain no word for it. Even the later Greek philosophy has not the Kalman notion of space, but only the definite place or the infinite. To Plato, in the Timaeus, it is known only as the nurse of generation. When therefore we speak of the necessity of our ideas of space, we must remember that this is a necessity which has grown up with the growth of the human mind, and has been made by ourselves. We can free ourselves from the perplexities which are involved in it, by ascending to a time in which they did not as yet exist. And when space or time are described as a priori forms, or intuitions added to the matter given in sensation, we should consider that such expressions belong really to the prehistoric study of philosophy, i.e. to the 18th century, when men sought to explain the human mind without regard to history or language, or the social nature of man. In every act of sense there is a latent perception of space, of which we only become conscious when objects are withdrawn from it. There are various ways in which we may trace the connection between them. We may think of space as unresisting matter, and of matter as divided into objects, or of objects again as formed by abstraction into a collective notion of matter, and of matter as rarefied into a space. And motion may be conceived as the union of there and not there in space, and force is the materializing or solidification of motion. Space again is the individual and universal in one, or, in other words, a perception and also a conception. So easily do what are sometimes called our simple ideas pass into one another, and differences of kind resolve themselves into differences of degree. Within or behind space there is another abstraction in many respects similar to it, time, the form of the inward, a space is the form of the outward. As we cannot think of outward objects of sense, or of outward sensations without space, so neither can we think of a succession of sensations without time. It is the vacancy of thoughts or sensations, a space is the void of outward objects, and we can no more imagine the mind without the one than the world without the other. It is to arithmetic what space is to geometry, or, more strictly, arithmetic may be said to be equally applicable to both. It is defined in our minds, partly by the analogy of space, and partly by the recollection of events which have happened to us, or the consciousness of feelings which we are experiencing. Like space, it is without limit, for whatever beginning or end of time we fix, there is a beginning and end before them, and so on without end. We speak of a past, present, and future, and again the analogy of space assists us in conceiving of them as coexistent. When the limit of time is removed, there arises in our minds the idea of eternity, which at first, like time itself, is only negative, but gradually, when connected with the world and the divine nature, like the other negative infinity of space, becomes positive. Where the time is prior to the mind and to experience, or coeval with them, is, like the parallel question about space, unmeaning. Like space, it has been realized gradually, in the Homeric poems, or even in the Hesiodic cosmogony, there is no more notion of time than of space. The conception of being is more general than either, and might therefore with greater plausibility be affirmed to be a condition or quality of the mind. The a priori intuitions of Kant would have been as unintelligible to Plato as his a priori synthetical propositions to Aristotle. The philosopher of Königsberg supposed himself to be analyzing a necessary mode of thought. He was not aware that he was dealing with a mere abstraction. But now that we are able to trace the gradual development of ideas through religion, through language, through abstractions, why should we interpose the fiction of time between ourselves and realities? Why should we single out one of these abstractions to be the a priori condition of all the others? It comes last, and not first in the order of our thoughts, and is not the condition precedent of them, but the last generalization of them. Nor can any principle be imagined more suicidal to philosophy than to assume that all the truth which we are capable of attaining is seen only through an unreal medium. If all that exists in time is illusion, we may well ask with Plato, what becomes of the mind? Leaving the a priori conditions of sensation, we may proceed to consider acts of sense. These admit of various degrees of duration or intensity, they admit also of a greater or less extension from one object, which is perceived directly, to many which are perceived indirectly, or in a less degree, and to the various associations of the object which are latent in the mind. In general, the greater the intention, the less the extension of them. The simplest sensation implies some relation of objects to one another, some position in space, some relation to a previous or subsequent sensation. The acts of seeing and hearing may be almost unconscious, and may pass away unnoted. They may also leave an impression behind them, or power of recalling them. If, after seeing an object, we shut our eyes, the object remains dimly seen in the same, or about the same place, but with form and lineaments half filled up. This is the simplest act of memory. And as we cannot see one thing without at the same time seeing another, different objects hang together in recollection, and when we call for one, the other quickly follows. To think of the place in which we have last seen a thing is often the best way of recalling it to the mind. Hence memory is dependent on association. The act of recollection may be compared to the sight of an object at a great distance which we have previously seen near, and seek to bring near to us in thought. Memory is to sense as dreaming is to waking, and like dreaming has a wayward and uncertain power of recalling impressions from the past. Thus begins the passage from the outward to the inward sense. But as yet there is no conception of the universal. The mind only remembers the individual object or objects, and is always attaching to them some color or association of sense. The power of recollection seems to depend on the intensity or largeness of the perception, or on the strength of some emotion with which it is inseparably connected. This is the natural memory which is allied to sense, such as children appear to have, and barbarians and animals. It is necessarily a limited in range, and its limitation is its strength. In later life, when the mind has become crowded with names, acts, feelings, images innumerable, we acquire by education another memory of system and arrangement which is both stronger and weaker than the first, weaker in the recollection of sensible impressions as they are represented to us by aorea, stronger by the natural connection of ideas with objects, or with one another. And many of the notions which form a part of the train of our thoughts, are hardly realized by us at the time, but, like numbers or algebraical symbols, are used as signs only, the slightening the labor of recollection. And now we may suppose that numerous images present themselves to the mind, which begins to act upon them, and to arrange them in various ways. Besides the impression of external objects present with us, or just absent from us, we have a dimmer conception of other objects which have disappeared from our immediate recollection, and yet continue to exist in us. The mind is full of fancies which are passing to and fro before it. Some feeling or association calls them up, and they are uttered by the lips. This is the first rudimentary imagination, which may be truly described in the language of Hobbes, as decaying sense, an expression which may be applied with equal truth to memory as well. For memory and imagination, though we sometimes oppose them, are nearly allied. The difference between them seems chiefly to lie in the activity of the one compared with the passivity of the other. The sense decaying in memory receives a flash of light or life from imagination. Dreaming is a link of connection between them. For in dreaming we feebly recollect, and also feebly imagine at one and the same time. When reason is asleep, the lower part of the mind wanders at will amid the images which have been received from without, the intelligent element retires, and the sensual or sensuous takes its place. And so in the first efforts of imagination reason is latent or set aside, and images, in part disorderly, but also having a unity, however imperfect, of their own, pour like a flood over the mind. And if we could penetrate into the heads of animals, we should probably find that their intelligence, or the state of what in them is analogous to our intelligence, is of this nature. Thus far we have been speaking of men, rather in the points in which they resemble animals than in the points in which they differ from them. The animal too has memory in various degrees, and the elements of imagination, if, as appears to be the case, he dreams. How far their powers or instincts are educated by the circumstances of their lives, or by intercourse with one another or with mankind, we cannot precisely tell. They, like ourselves, have the physical inheritance of form, scent, hearing, sight, and other qualities or instincts. But they have not the mental inheritance of thoughts and ideas handed down by tradition, the slow additions, that build up the mind of the human race. And language, which is the great educator of mankind, is wanting in them. Whereas in us language is ever present, even in the infant the latent power of naming is almost immediately observable. And therefore the description which has been already given of the nascent power of the faculties, is in reality an anticipation. For simultaneous with their growth in man a growth of language must be supposed. The child of 2 years old sees the fire once and again, and the feeble observation of the same recurring object is associated with the feeble utterance of the name by which he is taught to call it. Soon he learns to utter the name, when the object is no longer there, but the desire or imagination of it is present to him. At first in every use of the word there is a color of sense, an indistinct picture of the object which accompanies it. But in later years he sees in the name only the universal or class word, and the more abstract the notion becomes, the more vacant is the image which is presented to him. Hence if a word all the operations of his mind, including the perceptions of sense, are a synthesis of sensations, words, conceptions. In seeing or hearing or looking or listening, the sensible impression prevails over the conception and the word. In reflection, the process is reversed. The outward object fades away into nothingness. The name or the conception or both together are everything. Language, like number, is intermediate between the two, partaking of the definiteness of the outer and of the universality of the inner world. For logic teaches us that every word is really a universal, and only condescends by the help of position or circumlocution to become the expression of individuals or particulars. And sometimes by using words as symbols we are able to give a local habitation and a name to the infinite and inconceivable.